There's no question that both drug use itself and the organised crime groups that manufacture and supply the product can together cause enormous harm, not just to users, but also to their families and to their communities. Professor John Scott is the acting head of the School of Justice and Law at QUT. He maintains that people who sell illegal drugs don't always conform to the stereotype of a ruthless, violent, profit-driven criminal. His team has just published research looking at how 11 different countries deal with what he describes as social suppliers. It's a term he uses for low-end drug dealers. And this follows on from a previous study done 2 years ago where he and his collaborators interviewed 200 small-scale cannabis sellers around Australia. John Scott's research raises a controversial idea. Should we or shouldn't we use the full force of the law against these small-time drug dealers?
Yeah, look, this concept of social supply, it's emerged in the empirical research around drug use, and it's emerged in relation to certain types of drugs. Cannabis is a good one because it's the most widely used illicit drug in Australia and also worldwide. And it also accounts for the majority of law enforcement and apprehension. So if you look at something like cannabis in Australia, about 60-70% of arrests every year in relation to drugs or seizures are associated with cannabis. If we just look at the last, 2016, 2017, there were 77,000 arrests in relation to cannabis in Australia. So it counts for quite a bit of policing in that sense as well. However, it's very interesting if you look at the Australian situation and surveys that have been done, about 70% of the population say, you know, we don't condone its use. But about 30% of Australians will use cannabis from the age of 14 onwards, and about 10% of the population use it fairly regularly. So, you know, we're looking at one third of people have used cannabis and one in 10 people have used it fairly recently. So that's quite a few people engaging in what's criminal behaviour or illegal behaviour in most states.
So can we flesh out this idea of what social supply is?
So what I'm trying to talk about here is more informal drug distribution systems that occur among friends, acquaintances, and involve sometimes gift giving, sharing, or even people acting as go-betweens. There's also another concept called minimally commercial supply, and that is also used to account for people who are making a fairly small financial gain, adding a tax to what they're supplying, a bit of a markup, or even if they're involved in bulk purchases, which is often common in regards to certain drugs, including cannabis.
So essentially lounge room transactions as opposed to street dealing.
Absolutely, and that's a nice way of thinking about it. And when we've spoken to people about what actually occurs in transactions, they're not often as we'd imagine, as we see on movies or in popular culture. This kind of shady thing that occurs on a back street happens really quickly. Often people will go, especially in regards to cannabis, go to a supplier's house. They'll hang around for a while. They might watch some movies. They might grab a meal. Often they'll both share some of the cannabis, and they'll regard the relationship in terms of a friendship. And these people don't see themselves, this is what's really interesting, they don't actually see themselves, the people who are supplying, as real dealers. So they're people that are likely to describe dealers in terms that aren't too flattering. So they see dealers very much in that popular culture way of being people who are greedy, profit-driven, and who are untrustworthy. And these people regard themselves as being fairly trustworthy. And this is occurring, we think, in the majority of transactions around cannabis.
So some people will say, look, that's blindingly obvious. Others will say that's naive. Others will say that's missing the big picture about the harm caused by drugs. Let's come to those issues in a moment. Mm-hmm. You've done two pieces of very interesting research, you and your collaborators. The first one looked at how the criminal law does or doesn't recognise this concept of social supply. Mm. And you looked at the law in 11 countries. What did you find?
Yeah, well, just to go to Australia first, in the Australian Capital Territory, South Australia, Northern Territory, we've got a situation where cannabis use is decriminalised. But what we find in Australia and the various states is a lot of varying legislation, and it's mostly based around quantities. So everything from, I think it's 15 grams in New South Wales, where you get a caution for your first couple of times, to if you look at the Northern Territory, I think it's up to 50 grams, and you may be fined, or 50 grams and anything under, and you've got 28 days to pay and so on. So that the legislation in Australia is quite variable. Now, whether it's recognised, it's not officially recognised in Australia, this term social supply. However, there's been situations that we can cite where reference to something that I've just described as social supply, you can see there's been some reference. So in 2015, the Adelaide District Court, a defendant pleaded guilty to trafficking a controlled drug with a maximum of 10 years penalty or $55,000 fine or both. Now, the judge in that case suspended the sentence and contextualised the outcome, explaining while serious matters of importing, it was a serious matter importing 55 grams of MDMA, the defendant was not seeking to profit but distribute the substance among a group of friends. So he wasn't going to profit there. And what he was going to get in return was described as meals, probably some alcohol and so on. And so that was the context of that particular case. And there's been other cases on record where we can say that something resembling the social supply has been recognised. When we go to other countries, we looked at 11 countries in our study, and again, we found things highly variable. So if you go to Hong Kong, which was one of the countries, they've got a very prohibitionist regime around drugs there, and all drug taking seemed to be highly problematic, tough penalties encouraged, or at least symbolically out there. But often what we're seeing on the ground is this notion of social supply. If you're talking about people who are dealing in small amounts, there is a bit more flexibility, a bit more leniency shown.
What about places like across Europe?
Yeah, across Europe, there was a range of countries that we incorporated into the research across Europe, places like Finland, Belgium, Germany, the Czech Republic, and generally they take into account aggravating circumstances in terms of contextualising the supply. So things like the frequency of offending, the duration of offending, the financial gain, whether there was profit involved. So ostensibly, yes, social supply can be recognised in those situations.
Now, Professor John Scott, you've been looking at the law in various countries, but you've also done a really interesting study a few years ago on social suppliers or suppliers of cannabis. Who did you speak to and what did you find?
Yeah, we spoke to people aged between 18 and 30 years old who were, in the first instance, users of cannabis. We spoke to 80 people in Perth and Melbourne, and 40 in Armidale, which was, as many people know, pretty much Australia's only university town in northern New South Wales. We spoke to 40 people there. What we did find in terms of the research was that most of these people who had been involved in supplying cannabis, they really didn't, again, see themselves as dealers. They talk about the friendship. They spoke about their supply in, very much closed settings, a lounge room, as we were talking about before. And they spoke about what they did in terms of the reciprocity. Only a very small percentage saw what they did, whether they were buying or whether they were selling. It was 18% saw it as being strictly business. And only 8% of people would actually supply to strangers. So I think we had about 94% of people that we spoke to in the end had supplied and supplied fairly recently. And only 3% said they were profit-driven.
Is it possible that people are just telling you what you want to hear? I mean, this is a kind of a hippie, harmless, community-minded social endeavour, and people play down or disguise what's really happening. They are making big money and they don't care one iota about the people that they're selling their product to.
Yeah, look, that's possible. In the sense of making big money, that wasn't the case. So we did some measures of the quantities that they were trading and so on, and what they were profiting. And there was an indication that they were not making a lot of money out of what they were doing. They were very reluctant to identify as a dealer as such. And that was very clear. And if nothing else, that tells us something about that image of the dealer.
It is really interesting though, because we know at its heart, the illegal drug industry is a highly organised, highly criminal enterprise. And you're saying that people down the food chain somehow kind of almost launder or somehow kind of bleach away the criminality. But at some point, you've got to have one foot in either box or in either category. So it's not a black and white thing. People are stepping between these worlds. And one, I think we can say, is problematic and criminal, And the other one, you would argue, has this kind of social dimension.
Well, I guess the difference between, you know, the notion that there's, you know, there's a seedy sort of marginalised underground world of criminality, and then you've got this other world where people are law-abiding, I think it is very grey between the two.
Maybe let me distinguish that. Okay, manufacturing versus supplying versus consumption, right? And we know that we shouldn't be Pollyanna about this. The production of industrial quantities of drugs, we're not talking about people with a few pots in their garden or in their windowsill. The industrial production of illegal drugs, from cannabis all the way through to kind of ecstasy, through to speed, through to heroin, these are criminal enterprises. They're highly organised, highly ruthless, highly violent.
Yeah, well, look, we do know that in 2016 to 2017, there were 77,000 arrests associated with cannabis, which is actually the second highest on record. But of that 77,000, only 13% of the arrests were providers. And I guess what this concept of social supplies are doing in some ways is saying that often the people who are getting caught up, they aren't often the industrial commercial suppliers. We do know that in terms of those 70,000 arrests, a lot of those people could be people who would be regarded in the research that we've conducted as both users and social suppliers. And I think 25% of people who participated in our study had direct contact with the police as a result of the association with cannabis supply or use.
So you're saying that in terms of the people who come into contact with the criminal law, it tends to be a lot of people at this lower end as opposed to at the higher end?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that's been borne out in other research as well. A lot of police activity goes into, quite obviously, you know, given those statistics, into policing cannabis. But we know that, you know, most of the Australian population, although once again they don't condone the use of cannabis, they also think that people who are supplying small amounts of it, you know, for personal use, that this shouldn't be an offence as such. I don't think we're seeing that reflected in the way that we both police cannabis and in the law at the moment.
Professor John Scott, acting head of the School of Justice and Law at QUT.